right, welcome back to Hino's Home Show. So happy that you decided to join us again this week. I'm joined in the studio, as always, by the great Steve Kenny. Steve, how you doing today?
I'm doing good. I know I had a good week. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good, pretty good. We are brought to you by the fine folks over at Accurate Mortgage Group. They are a great bunch of folks, and if you're looking to buy a home or refinance a home, check them out at AccurateMTG.com, and they'll get you closed and back to life. And on that note, we've got a very special guest in the studio with us today. We've got Mike Hoover, the president of Accurate Mortgage Group, because we're going to be talking about something very special that's near and dear to, I know, his heart and some other people's heart. I know a lot of you probably think, you know, you go and you schlep all your stuff down to the beach, you go to Orange Beach or somewhere like that, and you just grab all your stuff, you go down there, and it's trying to find a place to stay and all that stuff, and you think, but wouldn't it be awesome if I just had a place down here, maybe a second home or a vacation home or something like that? How much easier would life be if I could have that? Or maybe think, oh, maybe I could rent it out and make a little bit of money while I'm not there. Well, that's the kind of stuff we're going to be talking about this week. The whole concept of vacation homes and second homes. And we'll kind of get into all that and how to pay for it. But first off, let's just say hello to our special guest, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on.
All right.
I don't know how special I am. I've been called special other ways before.
Yeah, that's true. I can understand that. So last I read that there's an estimated 1.13 million vacation homes that were sold in the U.S. last year, and that's according to the National Association of Realtors. And that's the highest number since they started keeping track way back in 2014. So it's obviously a very, very hot thing right now for a lot of people to do. Mike, what have you seen? What are some of the reasons that people even consider buying a vacation home?
You know, I 10 years ago, I don't think people owned vacation homes like they did today.
Okay.
And I think there's one thing you can look at, and that's short-term rentals that have opened that up.
Okay.
The internet and short-term rentals. I mean, you know, I had an investment property in Nashville during the mortgage meltdown in 2007, 2008. And if I would have kept it, like, Airbnb and VRBO wasn't around then, or at least if it was,
it was just starting out, I think.
And I had no knowledge of it, and so I ended up losing a lot of money on a property that I sold, because I had no outlet to rent it out. So what I decided to do was just get rid of it and cut my losses. And well, now I actually know people still have those in there, and they're renting those things out for like $500 a night.
Oh, man. Wow. That's so, called having long-term vision, yeah, long-term vision.
That would have covered the mortgage payment over a week.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people, or many people, especially if they're downsizing, you know, they've gotten to the point in their life where the kids are out of the house and they don't need the, you know, the big, huge space to take care of. They sell that house, and now they've bought a smaller one, but they got some money left over. So they're thinking, oh, maybe get one for the summers or for the winters, you know, depending on where you're from. Around here, you probably want one for the winters. Get away from the cold.
Absolutely.
And go somewhere else. Do you find that a lot of people rent them out to defray the cost of having the rental?
Oh, absolutely. I would say the vast majority that own places down on the Gulf Coast are short-term rentals.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you have it as an investment, I would imagine. I mean, how much of that should you factor into your decision long-term? I mean, is it an investment, or do you just enjoy it while you have it and leave it at that?
I think it can be a little bit of both. I think, you know, you go into it thinking, oh, this is a great place to be. I want to make, you know, family memories down here. But at the same time, when you see what it costs to stay down there for a week, and you think, well, if I buy this, maybe I can rent it out, make a little bit of money, maybe pay for it. And then in 10, 15 years, we can own this thing.
Yeah.
And it can be a supplemental retirement income.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, there's a few things that if you're thinking about buying a vacation home, there's a few things that you need to consider. The first, of course, is, you know, can you even afford it? I mean, that's kind of a big deal,
yeah,
right?
That's definitely a big deal.
Yeah.
You got to have the wherewithal to make that payment when you're not renting it out.
Yeah.
And down there, especially in the northern part of Florida, you basically have about 14 weeks that's your prime season, excluding fall break and spring break, you know, those kind of vary a little bit, but kind of between the end of May, Memorial Day through Labor Day, there's about 14 weeks that's peak rental time.
Well, you mentioned spring break. Has that become like a dirty word down there as far as renting out? I mean, are those is that the clientele you want?
I would say no.
Okay.
Yeah. We happened to be down in the Panama City area, and the police were called one night because there were 21 college students in a 3-bedroom.
Oh, nice. Wow. Yeah. That's not hard on an apartment, is it?
No. Just a little bit of damage.
Yeah. Oh, well, man. I'm sure the area that you buy is also going to play into that, too. You know, if you're in a more adult-oriented side of the beach, then you're probably going to get more of that kind of clientele. But if you're in one of those buildings that's right by the nightclubs, you know, you're kind of signing up for that. So you want to make sure you pick a good location.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
There's that. Minor detail. Well, can you really count on, if you're looking at it as an investment, can you really count on appreciation to bail you out if you've had the building for a while?
The thing about appreciation down there is it's all relative to repairs. There's anything that's right on the ocean just takes a tremendous amount of money to upkeep every year.
Because of the elements, the salt elements, water and all that?
It's so tough on just every building surface. There's nothing that they can make other than stainless steel that will withstand the ocean. So it requires painting and just a ton of maintenance.
Especially if there's decks and that kind of thing, repairing the wood.
It's very hard on homes.
Well, because I think in the last, quote-unquote recession that we had, Florida in particular, a lot of those homes lost more than half their value.
Very quickly.
You know, just like that.
Yeah.
And so if you're not in there for the long haul, like you were talking about earlier, where you can ride that out, you might be hurting a little
bit.
You'll
be putting up a for sale sign quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that, you could look at that, too, as a good time to buy. You know, if you're thinking about doing something and you want to hold on to the money, you think maybe we're at a peak or you're expecting values to change. Of course, nobody can predict when a recession is going to happen. But if you see that home values come down pretty quick and you've been thinking about getting a second home, that may be a good time to do it.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that you're going to have to really be sure about if you're thinking about buying a place is knowing the rules of that place.
Yes.
I mean, can you rent it out? I mean, how do you check that out, Mike, if you're thinking, okay, I might want to Airbnb that?
That's all going to be in the covenants, the documents that they establish there. And you'll know right away because they'll have a debt. It'll look like a hotel. It'll look very similar to a hotel. They'll have a guest check-in and check-out areas. And so when you walk into those condos, those are all condo developments, but they're privately owned or owned. Some of them are owned. There's, one person or a company may own several of them in there, and they do it for profit.
Well, last time my family and I stayed down there, we stayed just across the street from the beach. And it was like a small single family home. There was a bunch of them on a little street. So it wasn't a condo, but it definitely was a vacation home because you probably wouldn't want to live there year round. There wasn't enough space.
Yeah.
But it was perfect to spend a weekend. We had like 3 or 4 bedrooms and there was enough for everybody. And there was a little kitchen and a short walk to the beach. And I'm guessing in that situation, is there usually an HOA associated with those types of places?
Probably not. It would really depend if it's part of a development. Anytime you get in a planned unit development or a PUD, you're going to have an association.
Okay.
If those were individual lots that were handed down through family or just recently bought and sold as an individual lot, then no, it's not going to have an HOA.
Okay. Well, some of the costs that I think a lot of people don't realize or they need to take into account when they're thinking about buying a vacation home is obviously the purchase price. But then you've got utilities. You got to heat the place and have the water turned on, and HOA fees. How much can HOA fees run for one of those condos?
In some of those condos, HOA fees are upwards of $1,500 a month just for the HOA.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. And then, of course, property taxes and insurance, and you got to furnish the place.
The HOA in the condo units does cover the insurance.
Okay.
That saves you some money there. So there's, a little bit of give and take there. Because if you try to insure a single family dwelling on the beach in Florida, I mean, that's a steep, steep premium.
Wow.
You're probably looking to $8,000 to $10,000 a year for coverage because of hurricanes.
Yeah. Well, do you have to have any special insurance if you have short-term renters in there, something to cover them, like liability or that kind of thing?
Yeah, they have. There's a it's like a contents policy basically, and it covers damages.
Okay. Okay. Well, what about if you do decide to rent it out for income, what kind of things do you need to account for there? I mean, you're not, if you're charging, let's say $500 a night, you're not getting that whole $500. What all eats into that?
Oh no. The management company is going to take anywhere from 20 to 25%.
Wow. Typically. That much.
Oh yeah.
That much.
Yeah, but they cover a lot of things. Like they'll, a lot of times the management company will cut, they'll cover all the sheets, all the towels, all the incidentals, plates, knives, forks, small appliances, toasters, blenders, things like that. It's strange. People tend to take those things.
Really? A little souvenir fork. Yeah. Here's the fork I got in Florida. Yeah.
Look, a nice blender. I'm thinking I'm going to take that home. Okay. Margaritas for everybody.
Now, if they're going to take that big of a percentage out of what you're renting it for, are they also going to be the ones that are putting it on the internet and, you know, finding the clients and bringing people in?
They're responsible for the marketing of it and booking and all that.
And the cleaning afterwards.
And listening to complaints.
Okay.
Everybody wants everything immediately these days.
Yeah. So that's something to consider if you decide to handle all that yourself. You got to pay for all that and you got to factor all that in.
And you got to take those calls.
And you got to take those calls. All right. Well, then there's, of course, the dreaded taxes.
Like every state and Tennessee, including Tennessee, taxes short-term rental income as well.
Oh, okay.
And they get their share of all those.
Okay. Well, listen, we need to take a quick break, but we're going to come back and we're going to figure out some of the things that you have to think about. Now that you've got the home, what are you going to need to do to just manage it properly so that you can actually enjoy the thing? So come on back to Hino's Home Show. Oh, yeah. Welcome back to Hino's Home Show. Yes, we all want a vacation and a nice place to do it at. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about vacation homes. We are joined by Mike Hoover, president of Accurate Mortgage Group, and of course, as always, the great Steve Kenny. So, Mike, what do you think surprises people the most about owning a vacation home?
I would say the most surprising thing you always underestimate is how much it's going to cost to maintain that property. Mm. It's just like when you leave your house for 3 days, you can live at your house for 3 days and nothing seems to change. But if you go away for 3 days and come back, there's weeds everywhere. The grass grows twice as fast. It's just crazy how that happens.
Yeah.
So it's going to be the same way to vacation property. You know, you're not there for a month and you go and just, you know, the boards are falling down off the side of the house or, you know, windows need replaced or repaired or a water leak from the roof. Just things just tend to happen to things that are not occupied that you just don't anticipate.
Kind of like owning a boat. Seems like a great idea at first, you know?
The day you buy it, the day you sell
the,
it.
The yep. day you sell it, yeah. Well, so for people who are thinking about doing that and renting it out, how do you decide whether to go with a management company or do the Airbnb route or the VRBO route? How do you make that choice?
So I think a lot of that has to be is proximity, like we kind of talked about a little bit ago. How close you are in the case of emergency. You know, if you're an hour away from your vacation rental or your second property and you can get there to take care of a water leak or this, that, then I think it's great. If you're 8 hours away, I just don't think that's, you know, feasible. It's not going to happen. So
yeah,
you VRBO. They're not. You can't call them and say, "Hey, can you go fix that water leak for me?
Or right?
Can you take care of that?" And so, with an on-site firm, they typically have maintenance people that are there all the time. They're going to handle all complaints immediately right there, versus mm-hmm. you getting those phone calls.
Okay,
so there's a price for that.
Well, if you are close enough to do one of those online services, are there any advantages of one or the other, or can you do both?
You know, I'm not real familiar with them, so I wouldn't be able to speak to it. But I do know people that use them and use them with great success.
Okay.
And so they'll have their own cleaning firm go in there and they manage the property and manage the bookings and all that stuff.
So really, if you're going to use a management firm, probably your main goal is to just break even.
Yeah. I mean, it's more hands off. It's just way more hands off. You just kind of, you know, tell them the... You can still set constraints on how you rent. Like mm-hmm. you can set, you know, I'm not going to rent to a college student that's going to go in there and destroy the property. Not that all would, but during spring break, those things tend to happen.
Yep.
You know, refrigerators get thrown off balconies and things like that.
Oh, man.
hey, let's see if this will float.
Awesome. Yeah. Which is funny until it happens to you.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Well, and it sounds like too, with some of these management companies, you know, you can kind of decide what level of service you want to get. So like with an Airbnb or a VRBO, like Mike was just saying, you know, they're mainly going to help you get people to come stay at your place.
Right.
Once they're there, it's kind of up to you to handle, you know, the maintenance and making sure that everything runs and then cleaning it when they leave, you know, so those online services are mainly just to help you get people to come to your property.
They're just marketing it.
For yeah,
you. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So you could.
And collecting the money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course.
Yeah.
It's always about the money, right?
Yeah.
So you could have them handle that piece, and then you could have like a local property management firm who does that, handles the maintenance, handles the cleaning, that sort of thing. Or you could do that part on your own. Or, you know, in a lot of heavily vacationed areas, you know, like Panama City or anywhere on the Gulf Coast, really, or places like Myrtle Beach, there's going to be specific management companies either in that building managing it, or there are companies that are in the area. Like if you buy a single family home, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times if you've ever driven down like the main drags in Myrtle Beach, they all have signs out front that say like managed by this company.
Okay.
And so there's big companies that will handle all of that. And they also will do some of the online marketing, and they may even do some online marketing through like an Airbnb or a VRBO. Yeah. So, you know, depending on where your property is located and how involved you want to be, you really do have a lot of different options.
There are a lot of choices.
So Mike, yeah. have you come across where the actual HOA manages the building and manages the rentals and they keep it all in-house?
You know, I think it's bad when they monopolize that because the service level falls off.
Oh, okay.
Some of the places that I've talked to and people that I know that have those kind of sets up, they intend it to be that way. And then kind of they know that they have the whole pie, so their service level falls off and everybody's upset about that.
Competition. So it's always
that,
a good
that's
thing.
That's right. It's good to have competition and keeps everybody on their toes.
Well, speaking of competition, how do you handle family and friends wanting to stay at your place for free or next to nothing, during those 14 weeks when, you know, that's the all important time it is to rent stuff out?
Well, you have to be perfectly honest with them and say, look, you know, we have 14 weeks and yeah. to try to pay for this.
Yeah. So, mid-December, it's all yours.
Yeah, that's right. You know? Hey, this is our rental season here to here.
Yeah.
If you want that place there, this is the rate.
Okay.
And, you know, there's a market rate. That's sure. what it is. But outside of that window, you know, absolutely love to help you out.
Okay. And I think that's really good advice too, because I kind of look at this as, you know, not only do you own this place, but it's also money, like you were talking about. So anytime it comes to money with family and friends, having a set expectation is really the best way to go about it. You know, if that means, okay, the family's going to get to use it for 1 week in December, like you were saying, yeah. you know, make that very clear up front. If it's during the rental season, like Mike was just saying, you know, you're going to have to pay what the market rate is. You're not getting a discount just because you're family. We might give you priority in booking, but, you know, you got to figure out where that line is and really have a plan, because that can get real ugly real fast.
Yeah. Well, we'll supply a free six pack for you. It'll yeah. be waiting yeah. for you in the fridge there.
Hey, I left you a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah, there you yeah. go. You're welcome. Okay, well, so that's how you would handle that. Now, how often have you had that happen where people, you know, want to, or especially family, because family probably feels more entitled than anybody else. You know?
I don't think so. No, not at all. I think they respect it, and they know your intentions on the property is an investment property. I mean, it's not like they would say, hey, can I borrow your 401k for a week? Yeah. You know? So, you know, if you're up front with them and say, hey, this is an investment, it's not really, you know, it's a investment that can be used as a second
home. Yeah. Basically. Okay. And, okay. That makes sense.
Hey, for Thanksgiving, we're all going to come down here.
There you go. That's a nice way to do it. Now, since you do use it yourself sometimes, how much of your own personal stuff do you keep there?
Really as little as possible. It's just not, I don't know. It's just not something I do.
Or is there like a separate storage area that there you can is. Put there's, your stuff in?
There's always, typically in most places, there's always an owner's quarters or an owner's closet or something like that where you can leave a couple changes of clothes and things like that, so you're not bringing a bunch of stuff with you all the time.
All your toiletries and that kind of thing. Yeah, stuff yeah. that you know you're going to use, and that way you have to pack less.
Because everything else disappears.
Yeah.
The pepper, the salt, the sugar. Like,
that's
so
amazing
a lot of times
to
you
me.
You want to leave some of that stuff there so you're not having to run to the store and buy condiments and salt and pepper every time you go.
Wow. Okay. Well, since you've bought vacation homes in the past. If you were to do it again now, what would you do differently than what you did the last time?
Probably start at a younger age.
Okay. Yeah. Well,
I don't think there's any there's real estate is a tremendous vehicle in which to supplement retirement or save for retirement. I mean, there's, you know, tons of people, that's all they do is just buy and flip properties and buy long-term and short-term rentals. I just think it's a tremendous opportunity to build long-term for yourself.
Well, yeah, and I don't know how old this statistic is at this point, but several years ago, I want to say this was maybe 10 years ago, I heard this for the first time, 9 out of 10 millionaires become millionaires because of real estate. So,
okay.
You know, if you're looking at building wealth and trying to leave something to your kids, you know, because I feel like in building wealth, that's really the point. You usually do it more for the family, not for yourself. And so...
Huh. I hadn't heard that. No, just kidding. Well,
maybe we come from different sides. I don't know.
Sorry, kids.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, real estate is a great way to do that. And especially because it's also something that's tangible. You know, like when you talk about stocks or bonds, like those are financial instruments. It's basically just a bunch of paper, you know, and then you sell it and it's worth something and you get the money. But that's it. With real estate, whether it's a vacation home or a rental property or whatever the case is, you know, it's actually a physical place that you can go and you can enjoy it and be inside your investment. Now, you shouldn't monopolize your investment. You want other people to come so you make money, but it is cool to be able to go there and actually see the place and touch it and feel it. And, you know, it just becomes more real for people at that point.
Yeah.
And create memories. That's what it's really about.
Sure.
Creating memories with the kids.
So then how important is it to have where you buy your second home actually be a destination area? I guess that really depends on if you're planning on renting it out or not.
I really think that's the determining factor is how you want that second home to act. Is it just a place I want to go to on the weekends, like a lake house that you can go to every weekend?
Or like a cabin in Gatlinburg, for example?
Yeah, exactly. And even that from Nashville, it's a challenge to get there, four and a half, five hours.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a two-day weekend. That's more of a 3 to 4 day weekend trip because you got to
travel
half a day and travel.
Mm-hmm.
So, all that stuff's very important when you're thinking that out.
Well, have you noticed, is there a big difference in picking one that's by the beach or in the mountains? Are there advantages of let's say, Gatlinburg versus Orange Beach?
In my opinion, the beach destination is a little better for that kind of thing because it's almost recession-proof. It's not hurricane-proof, for sure.
Yeah.
But I think even now during the COVID, I mean, when Florida gave the green light to short-term rentals, man, it was...
Everybody rushed down there.
And they're rushing down there right now just to get out of their house.
Yeah, yeah.
And have some normalcy. Look, a beach I can lay out and get some rays and swim and, you know, just kind of forget about life for a minute.
I guess you can't really worry about the things like hurricanes and that kind of thing too much because stuff happens everywhere. I mean, Gatlinburg had a big fire not too long ago and a whole bunch of those places burned down. So no matter where you go, something can happen. And I guess that's what insurance is for, right?
That's right.
Right.
All right. Well, we're going to take another quick break here. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about how you can finance that vacation home. Let's say you can't pay cash for it. You might need a little bit of help. We're going to help you figure that out. So come on back to High Nose Home Show. Welcome back to High Nose Home Show. We are brought to you by the Accurate Mortgage Group. If you're looking to buy a home or refinance a home, check them out at accuratemtg.com. We'll get you closed and back to life. And joining us in the studio, of course, is Steve Kenny, the great Steve Kenny, I like to say, and Mike Hoover, president of Accurate Mortgage. So thanks for sponsoring the show there.
Thanks for having us.
Appreciate it. So, okay, so we've been talking about vacation homes and what all goes into that. And unless you're, you know, a gajillionaire, you're probably not going to be plunking down cash for your vacation home. Most people can't do that. They're going to have to look at getting a mortgage for that. But what a lot of people don't realize is that financing an investment property is kind of a different animal from financing your primary residence.
Absolutely.
There's different stuff that's required. And I figured let's talk about that a little bit so that people understand what might be facing them if they're looking to buy an investment property.
Yeah. So I think one of the important things right off the bat to discuss is whether or not it's going to be considered a true second home or if it's going to be an investment. You know, we've been talking about vacation homes just kind of in general, how you can use them to build wealth.
Sure.
Maybe get some cash flow to pay off the mortgage. The big difference kind of right off the jump is a second home is a home that you own and you're going to be the only person who's really using it.
Right.
You know, you might have some family who comes into town and they stay at your second home, but you're not owning it.
You're not making any income off of it.
Exactly. Yeah. As soon as you decide that you want to start making income off this property, that's generally when it becomes an investment property.
Right. And so, you know, although things might change down the line, when you go to buy that property, what your intent is for at least the next year after you close on the property Correct. Is kind of what's important. You're not thinking about renting it at that point. It's not to say that, you know, the police are going to come haul you off if 2 years from now you Airbnb it, you know, and like, aha, you did rent it out. You know, it's not like that. But definitely at the beginning, what your intent is on that property, you need to be upfront with the mortgage person you're dealing with.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you this. Is there any restriction on how many units your investment property or your second home can be? I mean, if you buy a duplex, for example, that's got two units, can that be a second home? Or obviously it could be investment property, but could it be a second home?
You can actually even do a primary with four units.
Really? Okay.
So as long as you're occupying one of those four units, it's mm-hmm. called a quadplex.
Yep.
So from a second home, you could do the same thing. If you're buying it, I think a quadplex would probably be about the max that you could do.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. Cause anything higher than that,
you start to get
commercial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a great way to go. I mean, my first home in Tennessee, when I moved here 20 years ago, I did a duplex and I lived in one side, rented out the other. And, you know, it was a great,
offset your expenses.
Exactly. Yeah, it was a great way to just be able to live, not rent free, but you know, as close as you can get to it, you know, right. by that. Now, well, I know one of the requirements for a second home or an investment property is that it's got to be suitable for year round occupancy. What does that mean exactly?
So it's funny, actually, you bring this up. I've only had this come up once in my entire career, whether a property was actually livable year-round or not. And for anybody who's familiar with the Midwest, the UP, or the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, is a very, very rural area. It's very beautiful. I mean, there's forests everywhere. There's lakes everywhere. It's awesome. But there's certain areas in the UP or even just in northern Michigan where during the wintertime, the roads are so treacherous, they don't plow them. You know, they're usually like dirt roads or gravel roads. They don't plow them and you cannot access them for the full year. So if it's a property that's like that, where it's in kind of a remote area and you couldn't just live there year round if you wanted to, that's where that cutoff is. And so that's a good example. If it's, you know, in a place that's really snowy, that in the summertime, it's beautiful, but in the wintertime, they just get feet upon feet of snow and mm-hmm. you just couldn't live there even if you wanted to.
Yeah. I guess down in Florida, that could be a problem. You might get sunned in. It might be too sunny, right?
You know? Yeah. I don't know if there is anywhere in Florida yeah. that really has that problem.
Yeah. I don't think so. I don't think so.
Hurricane season.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So another requirement is that you, as the homeowner, have exclusive control of the property for the entire year. So what does that mean? Exclusive control?
It's kind of like we were talking earlier, the difference between an investment versus a second home. With a second home, you have to be able to go there whenever you want.
Okay.
You know,
so if you've got a tenant in it, you can't just pop in whenever you want because
exactly
it's theirs for that time.
Right. When you lease a property out to a tenant, you're basically giving them rights to use the property. So by giving them rights, you're losing some of your own rights.
Right.
You know, and every state's different. Like one of the obvious rules a lot of people know about is you have to give 24 hours notice.
Right.
To your tenant if they're renting, you know, if you're renting it out to
that someone. You need to come inside for some reason.
Right. So you're not in full exclusive control during that time period because your tenant has some of those rights.
Okay.
So if you, like, you know, we were talking about earlier, if your family's going to come stay, you can obviously go there and stay with your family. You know, they're not paying you. It's not a business deal. It's just your family staying at your house.
Yeah. Now, what about timeshares? Is that treated any differently when you enter into that type of agreement?
Yeah, because a timeshare, you're buying a certain week. They usually split them up in 52-week increments, mm-hmm. and you're just buying that week snapshot of the whole property.
Okay.
And, you know, they're tradable. You can usually swap them for people, the different properties all over the United States and really all over the world.
Okay. But you can't really finance with a traditional mortgage. You can't finance a timeshare.
No, you can't. But they do finance them.
Yeah, but they do it themselves.
It's not a traditional Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and right. Short.
And that's why there's so many companies advertising on helping people get out of their timeshares. Yeah, you hear that a lot, don't you?
Yeah, a lot.
I think one of the things that surprises a lot of people when they start to look into buying an investment property is the whole concept of having to have reserves, having to have this pot of money accessible just in case. Can you talk about that and what's all involved with that?
Well, yeah, you know, they're along those same lines. Typically, when you buy an investment property, you're looking for a good deal. And in almost in every case, something's going to have to be upgraded, whether it be carpet needs replaced or new paint or new appliances or new furniture. And that can be tens of thousands of dollars, $50,000. It can be a ton of money. So you have to make sure you have those reserves to do that work. You know, one thing that people, a popular vehicle that people use to buy investment property is called a hard money loan. And it's for short term, but it's got a higher interest rate on it, you know, upwards of, you know, probably up to 10%.
Which is why they call it hard money.
Hard money, exactly. Yeah. But they fit a niche, you know, they're easy. You get them, you get your improvements, and then you refinance out of that and get into a conventional loan, you know, for long term.
And usually you're going to use a hard money loan for a property that really needs some work to it, right?
A lot of renovations, correct, yeah.
Right, where they maybe wouldn't qualify for a conventional loan because there's too much wrong with it.
Exactly.
Okay, I understand that. So in general, how much reserves would you say the average investor needs to have to buy an investment property?
You're typically going to need about 6 months reserves to qualify for a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac product.
And that's just for that property that you're purchasing, right?
Correct.
So if you've got other rental properties or, you know, you already own a second home, that number changes. And the equation is kind of a moving target. You know, we were just talking about this during the break. Depending on the number of properties you own, it's also going to be based on what your outstanding mortgage balance is for the property. So there's not really any, you know, other than the first 6 months of payments for the property you're buying, once you get into more properties, it gets a little bit more complicated. And there's not really there is a specific answer for it, but it's hard to discuss over the radio. So if you do have questions about that, you know, call us. We can walk you through that.
So going back to that the 6 months that you were just talking about, just to be clear, it's 6 months of the mortgage payments of the investment property. What about your primary residence? Is the mortgage payments of that factor into it?
No.
Okay, so it's just if my mortgage payment is $1,000 for my second home or investment property, I'm going to need to have $6,000 in the bank just ready to go.
Yes, and I will clarify that it's not just the mortgage payment itself. It also includes any HOA dues that you have to pay.
Right, and your property taxes and your insurance.
Right, exactly. So if you're one of those people who likes to pay your property taxes and insurance separately, you know, you can do that. You certainly can do that on a second home or an investment property, but those amounts have to be included. So it's not necessarily just what you write the check for.
Yeah.
It's for whatever your, quote, housing expenses.
That's right. Now, what can all be counted as reserves? It's not necessarily just cash in a savings account. What else can be counted?
That's a good question. So there's lots of different items that we can use to count as cash reserves. Some are easier than others. Probably the most common one we see is like 401ks.
Okay.
You know, 401ks, IRAs. We can only use a certain percentage of that because if you're under retirement age, which is 59 and a half, you are going to incur penalties, whether it's income tax penalties or just a penalty from the company they're going to charge you. So we can only use a percentage of what's in your 401k or your IRA. You can have CDs, certificate of deposit. We can actually use cash value on life insurance policies. I think I've maybe done that once in the last 10 years, so it's not very common, but if you just happen to have one, we can do that. So there's lots of different assets. Now, it has to be something that is either liquid or near liquid.
Right.
So
if in an emergency, you could get a hold of it.
Very quickly, yes.
Yeah.
And that's what we mean by that. So like if you've just got $100,000 in equity in your primary residence, well, that's not liquid. You know, real estate is illiquid.
Right, right. Is that a word, illiquid?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a Stevenism.
It's a Stevenism. I like it. I learned something today.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot to think about for buying an investment property or a second home, but we got a whole lot more of the show coming up. So come on back to Hino's Home Show. Oh, yeah, dancing in the studio here. Welcome back to Hino's Home Show. We've been talking in investment properties and vacation homes right here on Hino's Home Show. We are brought to you by Accurate Mortgage Group. If you're looking to buy an investment home or any type of home or refinance one, go to AccurateMTG.com. We'd be happy to help you out. I'm joined in the studio by Steve Kenny, as always, the great Steve Kenny, and Mike Hoover, the president of Accurate Mortgage Group, kind of is slumming today and came down and is hanging out with us here today. You know what, guys? I'm seeing refinances really, really spike recently. I mean, yes. they kind of went to sleep there for a little while, and now they're just all of a sudden really, really coming back.
Yeah, the Fed has done a pumped a lot of money back into the market and has driven down rates, and they're just, you know, they're at all-time lows, and what a great opportunity for most Americans to save hundreds of dollars a month.
Yeah, I mean, I read that refinances are up like 9.3% just for the week ending June 5th, which is not that long ago, and that was led by an 11% jump up before that, and that's according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. So, I mean, they're really, really up, and purchases, even with the whole COVID thing that we all went through, those are up as well. They're up about 5%, and they're about 13% higher than they were a year ago. So people are buying houses.
Well, with rates being so low, why wouldn't you?
Well, for a while there, people were kind of afraid to put their house on the market. You know, they were either afraid to have people coming through it and have them breathing all over their stuff, you know, and or whatever the reason was, or that people were worried that maybe they wouldn't have a job in a week because of everything that went on, you know, people having to work from home and all companies downsizing temporarily. But now we're kind of, seems like we're on the other side of that now.
Let's hope so.
Yeah. So rates are, we keep hearing historical lows. What does that mean exactly, historical lows?
Historical lows, I mean, you know, they've been measuring interest rates for 50 plus years.
Okay.
And basically over the last 50 years, you know, they've only hit a 30-year below 3%, you know, just a very sliver of a time.
Okay.
And it seems like now they're there and, you know, 15 years or you know, well into the mid to low twos. And
right.
Just an amazing time.
Yeah, I think I remember last time rates were this low was for about 2 weeks, like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like 9 or 10 years ago. So it's been a long time since we've been anywhere close to this.
And they're actually hanging out there.
Right.
Pretty consistently right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, certainly we don't have a crystal ball, so we can't project what they're going to do over the coming period.
Don't you wish you had a crystal ball? That would be amazing.
I do. But yeah, you know, like Mike said earlier, you know, the Fed has really done a lot to support the financial industry in general. And as we get more comfortable dealing with a post-COVID life, you know, whether that means, you know, changing some of the small things that we do, or, you know, certain things are just going to go back to the way that they were before, everybody's kind of working through all those issues and life's kind of getting back to normal. And so a good example of that is, like we were talking about earlier, with trying to sell homes, you know, people are getting accustomed to using some of the technology where, you know, you do like a 3D preview of the house, or the agents are going through. We just had Wendy Dyes on
last week.
Yep. And she was talking about doing Zoom calls with people. And so, you know, if I want to look at a house, I can have the real estate agent go and show me the house and answer all my questions. And, hey, you know, go back and look in that closet. I want to see that one more time. So there's a lot of ways that everybody's kind of moving past this. And so, you know, certainly rates are low and it is a great time to refinance. But if you're looking at buying a house, you know, now could be a great time to lock in that rate, you know, because if you look at the house that you're in now, you know, and you're looking at your mortgage rate going, hey, you know, I could do better than this. Well, if you're thinking about moving in 6 months, it doesn't make sense to refinance.
We have that happen. I've actually had several conversations with people over the last couple of weeks about that very thing. They wanted to refinance to get to lower rate because they wanted to save money between now and 6 months around when they were going to sell the house and move anyway. You know, and I had to tell them, yeah, it's probably not a good idea to refinance because there is an expense.
Right.
As with any transaction, there's built-in costs. And if you're not going to be in the house long enough to enjoy the lower rate that you got, it's not worth doing.
Right. Right. And you really do want to be in a mortgage for, you know, at least 6 payments, you know, is kind of the minimum cutoff. And then after that, it usually takes a year or two before you're going to recoup your closing costs.
Yeah. And that's kind of a good rule of thumb to look at. If you plan on moving out of that house before your monthly savings pays for the cost of doing that transaction, then it's probably not a good idea.
That's right. But I have done several loans recently for people who've been in the house just over a year. So it really doesn't, it kind of depends on, you know, how high the rate was when they got the loan. But in some cases, I mean, there was one person that I talked to earlier today, they've been only in the house about 7 months and it's like almost a point less.
In the end of 2018, beginning of 2019, you know, rates were in the mid to low fives.
Yeah.
And so now you're saving someone 2%, you know, per month. It's a tremendous, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars on their total payback.
What's crazy is that there's a study that was done by, there's a real estate research firm called Black Knight, and they're estimating that 14 million mortgage holders right now are in a good position to refinance, and they haven't. So they have equity or they have higher rates, and there's a good reason for them to look into it.
So there's some other estimates that translate that into a volume perspective. Mm-hmm. So it's about $10 trillion of home equity across the U.S. can benefit from a refinance right now.
Wow.
This is the problem. The mortgage industry is only built to handle about $2 trillion of transactions per year. So even though there's $10 trillion that need it, they, from a support perspective and a transaction perspective, we can only process so many customers before our service levels just tank.
Right.
So it's going to be interesting. But yes, I would say call your local mortgage company as soon as possible and get in line.
Yeah.
They want to help you. They want to do everything they can and you know, put as much money back in your pocket as possible.
But we are partial to Accurate Mortgage, of course.
We are.
You know, sure. You can find us at accuratemtg.com or highnosehomeshow.com. There's a great way to reach us in either case. As a rule of thumb, how much would you say that the rate should decrease on a refinance to actually make it worthwhile?
I have a rule, I guess, or a philosophy that I never try to put myself in someone else's shoes. It's hard to know what's important for that person. So
okay, I see what you mean.
Everybody's individual situation really determines that fact of when what's important to them and what benefits their family the most.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, generally, in general terms, if you're just keeping your payment the same, you should always look to shorten your term. That's the number one objective, is try to shorten your term whenever possible. If that's not possible, then you definitely don't want those costs to refinance to, you know, stretch on for 4 or 5 years. So generally, if you can reduce your interest rate by 1%, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, and to add on to that too, you know, a lot of things have changed over the last 10 years since I've been in this business. Back 10 years ago, you know, we were doing mortgages, $100,000, $150,000, $200,000. Now, with the way home values are, especially in places like Nashville, where it's so expensive to buy a house, a lot of people are getting bigger and bigger mortgages. So when you have a bigger mortgage, even if you can only save like 0.5% on your interest rate in real dollar amounts,
that translates into a pretty big difference in payment.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So
that's
like
a good point, Steve.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Mike's saying, you know, everybody's situation is a little bit different. And even too, like there's lots of different ways that you can refinance. So one, you know, we talk to people about buying down their interest rate, right?
Right, right.
So it's going to cost you a little bit more money up front, because essentially what you're doing is, you know, prorating some of your interest. You agree to pay, hey, I'm going to pay a little bit more right now so I don't pay a lot more later. That's one example. But you can also look at, and this again works a little bit easier with bigger mortgage sizes, but you can look at doing a no-cost refinance. It is possible. You know, not everybody decides to do that, and there's lots of different ways that you can look at it and when it does and does not make sense. But there's lots of different ways that you can take advantage of doing a refinance that are not just, oh, I lowered my interest rate by 1%.
Right, right. Now, of course, a cash out refinance, that's a whole other animal. So in that case, the benefit for most people is that they're accessing their equity and they're getting the cash out to do whatever it is that they need to do, whether it is to pay off high interest rate credit cards or to do some work on the house. So in that case, interest rate is less of a factor, you know, so it's less important, because in that case, getting that $50,000 is more important because you need to add on a bathroom or whatever it is that you're trying to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, if, like you were saying, if you're going to consolidate some of your debt, you know, you also want to be looking at the interest rates of the debt that you're paying off. You know, so if your mortgage, rate is at, you know, I don't know, 4.5%, you're going to do cash out. Now your rate's going to be 4%. You're still getting a lower rate. One, you know, it may not be a full percentage point, but if you're paying off a personal loan that's at 12%,
right,
you know, or credit cards that are 18%
or
know,
more
or more. Yeah. Yep. I think the max is like 37% or something like that.
Ouch. Yeah. Ouch.
But if you look at that, you can decide, you know, and do the math, like how much money am I going to save by paying all this off, putting it into my mortgage? And then not only how much am I going to save in interest, but how much am I going to save on a monthly basis?
Right.
You know, we look at that with clients a lot.
All the time. Yeah. You add up all those payments. Let's say you're paying $2,000 a month for all your stuff. And now your mortgage payment is $1,500. You're saving $500.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're already used to paying that $2,000, you can take that savings and put it back on your mortgage and pay that thing off in a really short time. You know, maybe your 30-year mortgage becomes a 15-year just by doing that.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we've had a great time. Mike, thanks for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me. Really
Mike,
enjoyed it, guys.
President of Accurate Mortgage Group, and Steve Kenny. Check us out at accuratemtg.com or check us out at highnosehomeshow.com. We would love to chat with you, whether it's about refinancing or buying a house. We'll get you there. We'll get you closed and back to life, as we like to say. So until next week, we'll see you on High Nose Home Show.